Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight we go back in time, the season's past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gained, one final score which would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and its Memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network. We're in conjunction with Swick Enterprises, and we're live from the Southport, North Carolina home, Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia. You can find us on the web at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. It's at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian, specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Lord. He hails from Portland, Oregon. Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show this evening.
Red Grange and Steve Largent. That's me, Bob. Great to be on the show.
Good to be back from last week's show, which got a rousing, thunderous applause from many people. Interesting hearing what our last guest, Ken Crippen, was talking about, especially about the Pro Football Hall of Fame. I got a lot of feedback on it. It was pretty interesting to read and hear and talk to people about it one way or the other. But in any event,
You know what? That was just something I pulled off of his website when I was doing some background on him. That wasn't one of our questions to ask. That was just I noticed he had that criteria, the Hall of Mediocrity. And we talk about that a lot, you know, amongst us collectors, just how it's being diluted. That was just kind of an innocuous question. I wanted his opinion on it, and that turned into a great topic.
And again, I think he reinforced what I had been feeling for a long time, that the Hall of Fame really, I don't know why a lot of those guys are in there. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, and I'm not trying to belittle the guys, but it's, you know, you've got to really, to me, play at a pretty high level if you're considered a Hall of Famer. And, again, because you got a lot of younger guys who don't see anything else, this is who they're going to vote for, and that's it. And that's not really a good situation for the Hall of Fame in any way, shape, or form. But in any event, before we get started on what we're going to talk about, I want to point out, and we had talked about this beforehand, we've gone over pretty much the 35 Chickle set, the 48 to 55 Bowman football sets, and we discussed the 55 All-American set. So naturally, our next step would be talking about the 56 top set, because we try to talk about at least one set each month's show, one of the shows during the month. But because our special guest tonight is such an expert on it, we're going to hold off and we'll engage a conversation with him on the 56 top set. So we'll go a little off script here. I'm going to hand off to you, Joe, about a very interesting vending box that's up for auction right now.
Yeah, two vending boxes in Heritage. I love auction season, and it seems like auction season is ongoing lately. But two really interesting vendings coming up. First one in Heritage that end in about a week is a 1959 vending first series. It's at 32,000 right now. It's described as 500 loose cards with 71 seven-card packs. So at some point there were two pictures, one of the bottom and one of the top of it, but it's not sealed. It's not BBCE sealed. And I'm like, okay. So you can ask a question at the bottom like, hey, would you mind sending a picture of what it looks like inside? When you say packs, what do you mean? Because I didn't know vending came in packs. And, of course, I never got a response. But today I went to look to see what price it was at, and I noticed they added a picture. And the picture was of the inside of the box, and they added a description. We didn't mean to call them packs. What they are is they're bundled. And the quote is, like one would associate with currency. And if you look at the picture, it's like money, like money, where they've bundled it together with brown paper. So there are 71 seven-card groupings, bundles, that are wrapped around the middle with a band of brown paper. Obviously, this isn't, as I mentioned, not BBCE sealed. So, you know, the problem is somebody, you know, it's not like you can find these seven-card bundles, you know, around. But obviously somebody could go into those bundles and kind of look and see what the card is, pull them out, and then slip a card in. So, I mean, the fact that it's not BBCE sealed, the fact that nobody's seen it, I mean, 32K, a little bit of a roll of the dice there, even though it's a beautiful set. I love the 59 top set.
I never saw that brown wrapper. However, my memory is being jogged right now. I vaguely remember someone talking about that years ago, that was a very common way of the way the vending boxes or certain vending boxes were. I can't confirm that one way or the other. But that's interesting. And, again, it's not sealed. I don't know why anybody would be paying that kind of money on it for. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. Because you could get a good dog there, and or you're figuring you're going to buy it with the caveat you're going to
– Bob, did we lose you? Now
– Joe, I'm here.
Okay, so I think Bob's having audio problems, but we'll move on to the other vending that we're talking about. Thanks, Kurt. I appreciate it. I never know if it's me or, you know, technology on the other side. And so Bob's in control of the control panel. The other vending that's for sale in Heritage is a 1968 Series 2 vending, again, with 500 cards like the 59. This one's at 6,000, and it's sealed by BBCE. So the fact that one is sealed and one isn't, a little bit of an eyebrow raise, but, you know, Steve Hart, he's been a guest of the show, a very fascinating guest to talk about his expertise, you know, stuff like that. It's just, why is one sealed, one not? You know, that would almost warrant, you know, something in the lot description, like, you know, we sent this to BBCE. You know, Steve looked at it, says it's authentic, it appears on, you know, something. I've seen those descriptions before. But 68 vending series 2, you know, which, you know, obviously has like Bob Greasy in there. It's only at 6K sealed and about one-fifth the price of the 59 vending unsealed. There's two very rare vending. I've never really been a big vending collector just because of the way the cards are in the box. You know, the box can get dinged and affect the edges of the car. I guess you could say the same about wax packs, but packs.
I remember back in the early 1980s, there were a lot of closeout vending boxes, which were 500 card boxes, especially for baseball, that a lot of dealers used to just get rid of for $5 a box. And it was the same deal like with the wax boxes, where you had the black line put through the front of the box, so you know it was a return. And you would buy the returns for a nickel a pack, which was $1.80 a box. And a lot of dealers used to resell them for $5 a box at the same time. But again, vending boxes, unless they are sealed or unless the provenance on them is really pure, I really hesitate to say if I would buy a vending box and spend that kind of money. That's why I'm kind of surprised on the 59 box right now. Doesn't really make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. Kind of cool, a good glimpse of history. I've never seen them packed like that, I guess would be the best way to say it. And today when I saw they added that description, like one would bundle currency, I also noticed that third picture that they added, which, people shouldn't have to ask for that. And it was fascinating to look at it.
Especially on a $32,000 bid. What, are you going to be kidding me? I mean, what is the top and the side of the box,
yeah.
I mean, it's ridiculous. Don't even show me the box. Let me just bid at it blind. Put my bid in for $50,000. Don't worry about it. No big deal. And if there's like five cards beat up in there, that's it, you know.
Yeah,
I don't know. I just don't get it sometimes. I don't know. I don't understand the hobby sometimes. This is one of the times that I really don't understand it. You know, you guys, not you, but I'm just saying, the auction houses, you know, claim every other one is the greatest, better than the other one, so on and so forth. Then you see something like this and you say, why would I put my collection in this company's hands if they can't even describe it correctly? And they don't even want to show a picture of it at the same time. Good Lord. Unbelievable.
Yeah, if you're the consigner, it's one of those where it's like, hey, man, can you show a few more pictures? But Heritage is obviously a good auction house. They draw a lot of consignments. They, you know, but they're also, you know, they have an attention problem, a focusing problem. You know, they do real estate and art and, you know, automobiles. I mean, you click on that, you have to dig down to sports is one category out of, you know, 15 on their website, and then in sports it breaks it down. Whereas other auctions, you know, you go to REA, you know, or Love of the Game, and it's, you know, it's sports. It's all sports. It's their focus. So you're probably going to get a little bit better write-up, a little bit more care. You know, they know. So who knows?
Well,
you know,
that's why I do agree with you. An REA auction, a Love of the Game auction, or a Leland's auction, I mean, you're confident. You don't really have to worry about something like that when you say, but again, I just really, I can't fathom that you would have to get that question asked about a piece as, in my opinion, very valuable and very rare in the hobby. And again, it's treated like, you know, whatever, a common box of cards or whatever. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
Really doesn't.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Really cool to see, really, really cool to see old, you know, and, you know, it's a good segue for our guest coming up because, you know, he's collecting unopened as well. But it's, you know, just people's opinion on that. I'm not a big fan of vending, like I said, just because of, you know, at some point somebody's had access to that box and been able to pick through it unless, as you mentioned, you absolutely know the provenance of it. You know,
Right.
You know, it's, just it's hard not to show it's been picked through, but oh, well. That's just me. Some really cool things. I love auctions. REA just popped. Memory Lane's running. Gosh, we've some good auctions. Memory Lane just ended. Mile High just started. So, yeah, it might be winter still, but it feels like auction season.
Right. Well, our special guest is here, and I'd like to introduce him to our audience. Our special guest tonight, while growing up near Iowa City, he was raised an Iowa Hawkeyes fan and remains so to this day. As a kid, he was an avid sports card collector, with basketball and football being his main focus. After high school, he attended Iowa State University to study engineering and returned to his hometown afterwards to work in the family business in 2003. About this time, he rediscovered his childhood card collection, and he got back into collecting. As he started joining online forums and meeting other collectors, he started to define and narrow his collecting focus. One collector, our co-host, Joe Squires, was very inspirational to him as Joe is assembling graded football card sets from the 35 single set through the mid-80s. The task seemed daunting and challenging, yet exciting, and something he could work on for years to come. So he decided to tackle a similar project from 1930 for the 1972 top set. Throughout his time collecting, he started to become more intrigued with the dealer side of the hobby. I began to straddle the fence between collector and dealer. Around 2019, he decided to leave his job and started selling sports cards full-time through his company, BBC Emporium Incorporated. At this time, I'd like to welcome our special guest, Mr. Kurt Vigal. Kurt, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much for having me. It's an honor and... It's a little intimidating to be in the presence of two hobby legends such as you two.
You know, I was thinking about it, Kurt. The last time I saw you, we were taking you back to the airport there from Jeff Payne's house and his little gathering that weekend. And I remember commenting to – we were in the car with Mike Blaisdell, who was driving. After we dropped you off, we went back to the hotel, freshened up, and then we found a local restaurant bar there, and we – ended up watching the night game, got something to eat, and we were talking about the hobby. And I said to him straight out, I said, you know, I really like Kurt. I had communicated with him via email, and I never met him in person, but I thought it was very, very, very good to see someone younger getting into the hobby who has some enthusiasm and has a good set of ethics and moral values in his dealings. And you were talking about the business at that time, so I thought it was a good situation. And now we fast forward, what's it now? About four years later, and look what happened. It's kind of amazing to me. So I got to congratulate you on doing well and working with collectors and with people buying their collections and so on and so forth. I know it's a daunting task, one way or the other. Trying to help and trying to find cards, and you're doing a great job. I'm glad to see it.
I appreciate those kind words, Bob. I tell you what, I enjoy what I do, and you know, frankly, I wouldn't be where I was at if it wasn't for other collectors like yourself and Joe. I've learned a lot from you guys, and like I said, both you guys have been pretty inspirational for me in my journey. So. I appreciate what you guys bring to the hobby as well.
Well, thanks. But I'm gonna lead off tonight. We'll get back to you now. Can you tell our audience how you became interested in football and in football card collecting?
Sure. Give you a little background of myself. I grew up in small town Iowa. Growing up, I was very involved in all types of sports. I ran track, played basketball, wrestled, played football. Football was definitely my primary sport. I was a running back and a linebacker, and it was by far my favorite sport. And after high school, when I moved back, I actually participated, and I did high school. I coached high school football for a few years as well. So in terms of the sport itself, it's always been something I've played, and it kind of naturally led into collecting football cards. Ironically, growing up, I grew up in the mid-90s, probably like when Michael Jordan was at his heyday, at his peak. So when I was collecting cards as like an elementary kid, I collected all sports. During that time, my main focus was probably basketball. As I said, I was a big Jordan fan, but also probably my favorite basketball player was like David Robinson. My favorite football player was Barry Sanders. So it wasn't until later on, post-college, when I got into collecting seriously, did I kind of start to kind of really define and narrow my focus and get into the football cards. But, yeah, that's kind of a brief history of how I gained interest in the sport and the hobby.
You know, it's interesting when you're talking about Michael Jordan cards. I do remember it. I know this got nothing to do with football, but when back in the 80s when I used to set up, at the end of the 86-87 basketball season, it was very common for any sport. Dealers would try to get rid of their excess wax boxes and put that money into the newer wax boxes that were coming out. So guess what? There were a lot of 86-87 wax packs being sold very cheaply, wax boxes being sold for $5 and $10 at the time. And I always said to myself, I think back, and because I had no interest in basketball, I would never, you know, want to buy those boxes or whatever type of thing. And I remember handling several 86-87 basketball sets over the years, back in the 80s mostly, before the explosion occurred. And I look back at it and I say, wow, I could never imagine how valuable those cards became as the years went on. It was just truly amazing to me to watch. And one other quick basketball note, again, nothing to do with football. Star basketball was very unpopular at the time. And I remember several dealers who got, you know, for lack of a better term, clearance lots of them in the actual star bags. And they couldn't even sell them for like $5 a bag or whatever type of thing. So I just got to laugh at what I saw many, many years ago, to say the least.
Well, I can tell you, for me, I growing up, like the 86 Fleer cards, I mean, those were things of myth. I mean, I couldn't even imagine having an 86 Fleer card when I was a kid. Like, I was like buying like 1990 Fleer packs. I remember I got a hold of like a dozen cards from the 1987 Fleer set, and I mean, I just thought these things were the rarest thing ever. And when I got back into collecting, I remember the very first card. I went on to eBay. I bought a 1987 Fleer Isaiah Thomas. That was the very first card I bought when I got back into collecting. I'm like, I mean, it all went downhill after that. But, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Hey, so 86 Fleer was rare even in the early mid-90s for you, Kirk?
Well, yeah, so for me, and I don't know if it was just the stores that were selling cards, but, yeah, like, you know, at that time, like I said, it was probably late 80s, early 90s. I think at that time the 86 Jordan rookie had started to gotten a little bit more notoriety, and it wasn't as cheap as before. But, like, now, like, I never once saw an 86 Fleer card growing up. I saw them, like, in Beckett Price guides. I'm like, oh, man, if only if. But, yeah, I've never seen them.
I own one wax pack that is not football, and it is a 86 Fleer basketball. I splurged on it about 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Joe, at the next Nationals, you try just busting the pack, see what happens.
Well, the collation of those packs is very well known, Bob, and I peek. And let's just say I already know I don't have a Michael Jordan in my pack.
Yeah. I believe it.
Kirk, man, thanks for being on the show. And I appreciate the nod, you know, in your introduction, dude. And right back at you. You've always been a really classy collector. I obviously, you know, gravitate towards like-minded, you know, cool people who appreciate the hobby. So, I don't know. I've considered you a good friend for a long time. I wanted to add a couple things to your bio. I looked up your Hawkeyes, your 56, you know, 1956 Topps Hawkeye set. You've had the number one spot in the 56 Topps set from 2012 to 2022. That's 10 years. 2019, you got a Hall of Fame Gold Star for one of the top football sets. And in 2022, you got the red 10-year ribbon. Your number one set, you have a 9.1 GPA, and that weighted GPA thing that they do, you have a 9.72. You have 13 one-of-one PSA 10s. It's an incredible set. So when Bob and I were running down, like, all right, well, 56 Topps is next. I'm like, man, there's nothing that we could say that you couldn't say 10 times better. That's where the idea of having you on the show is. So, you know, so you are the expert. So let's start in on the 56 Topps set and what you can share with our audience about it.
Sure. So first off, I'll give you a little bit of background of how I got into the 56 football set. It was a little bit by circumstance and chance. Like, going into it, the 56 set was not, like, my favorite set. In fact, you know, just jump ahead a little bit. I'll get into this more in depth as we go through some more questions. But kind of my collecting focus eventually became graded sets from the 35 Chickle all the way to 72 Topps. And kind of what I was looking for, and Joe is very similar to kind of the scope of your collection. I was trying to put together all of those sets and kind of the 8 range is what I was shooting for. So, you know, I can recall there was a Memory Lane auction that came out, and they were selling off, I believe it was either the number one or the number two 56 football set. And I'm like, man, like, this is a lot nicer condition than what I'm going for in the other sets. But I'm like, you know what, you know, it's I was able to pick it up at a pretty good price. And I thought, well, this will be the one set I kind of go wild on. Like, I typically didn't like spending, like, big money, like, on these high-grade commons. But for the 56 set, I made an exception. So I spent a bunch of money on buying the set. And then I remember, and Joe, you may not recall this, but I actually came to you and got some advice from you. Like, after I bought that set, like, Memory Lane ran another auction. Like, the following auction, they were selling a bunch of 56 individual cards, like, all in 9s and 10s. And I'm kind of like, oh, crap. I just spent a bunch of money on buying this set, and now I got all these upgrade opportunities. I'm like, man, I'm like, I was scared that I was, like, putting too much money into these cards.
Yeah.
Like, man, it's like, this seems a little bit, you know, out of control. So I remember it was right around the National, Joe, and I said, Joe, these cards are coming up. I'm like, I'm not sure if it's worth going after them. And you, honestly, I forget the advice you gave me, but you kind of gave me some, like, general rules of thumb, like, hey, you know, pay what you feel comfortable. I forget the exact thing, but I ended up picking up, like, 20 PSA 10s. Yeah, it was real impactful. So I ended up, like, upgrading that set, like, very quickly out of the gates. And, you know, from that time on, it was kind of like, wow, it's like, so as you're chasing after, like, the best of the best in a set, you start to learn a lot about that particular set. You start to understand why certain cards are very difficult to find. You start to find little nuances in the set. And, you know, so anyway, all that background saying, that's kind of how I got into the 56 set. When I look at a football set, there's kind of three things I typically look at to determine how much I like a set. First off, you know, you have to kind of look at the overall card design. Quite frankly, the 56 set on a design standpoint, I don't mind it. It's not my favorite. In fact, it's probably kind of middle of the pack. It's got very, like, bold, strong colors. So, like, from an appearance standpoint, like, it's not at the top of my list. The other thing I look for is kind of, like, does it have, like, a good crop of Hall of Fame rookies included? You know, the 56 set, it isn't bad. I wouldn't say it's got, like, any, like, real super high-caliber rookies. Got, like, Lenny Moore, Roosevelt Brown, Joe Schmidt.
Five Hall of Fame rookies.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Bill George and Stan Jones. So, you know, once again, it's got a pretty decent selection, but not like off the charts. Nothing compared to, like, the 52 Bowman or something like that.
Yeah.
But then the last criteria I kind of look at is, you know, are there some challenges within the set in terms of, like, short prints, you know, really hard variations? And that's where I think the 56 set's got some neat challenges. You have not just the cards themselves, but you have the contest cards, which we can kind of delve into a little bit. And then overall, in terms of the 56 set, everything's fairly easy to acquire. There's, if you look at the overall sheet layout, there's two teams. If you look at the sheet first off, you'll see that every row of the sheet is made up of a team from the set. So, like, the 49ers makes up a row, and so on and so forth.
Yep.
If you kind of look at how the set was laid out on the sheets, every team was on the sheet twice, except for the Cardinals and the Redskins. Those were single-printed cards, and because of that, they're easier to acquire. So that's kind of like a real general background on the 56 set. I got a few, like, anomalies and, like, little things that we can delve into, unless you guys got some questions beforehand.
Pretty rare to lay a sheet out by team. Because usually sheets are laid out by color, so they can, for saving ink. So I noticed that because, I have a partial 56 uncut sheet, and that was one of the first things I noticed. And it's absolutely unique to the 56 set to lay it out by team. So, and talking about how difficult some cards are, one thing I noticed in your set, number 49, Eddie LeBaron. You have a PSA 8.5. It is a 1/1, none higher. What's up with that card?
So once again, that's going to come, from the Redskins, and which is a short printed one of the short printed teams from that set. Now, here's most, and I would say pretty much any of your average collector is going to kind of know that those two teams are short printed. What a lot of people may not realize is there was a big find of 56s, I want to say back in the late 90s. And the odd thing about this find is there was only a very limited number of cards that were included in this find. This find did not have, like, every card across the set. And interestingly, there was a lot of Cardinals cards that were found in this find. And if you kind of map out the cards that were found in this big find, there's a very distinct pattern on the uncut sheets from this find. For example, a good example would be like George Blanda. If you've ever noticed, it's very easy and they're very plentiful to find a George Blanda in a 9 or a 10. That happened to be one of the cards that was in this big find. So as a result, that card's very plentiful. Another thing is there was a lot of Cardinals cards that were found in this big find. So why those cards are short printed, I would say about half of them are fairly easy to find. Take like the team card, for example. You look at where it lays out on the sheet, the Cardinals team card, very lower left corner. And as you guys know, cards that are located in the corners of sheets, they're typically more susceptible to centering, wear, things like that.
Yep.
So you have this card that's in the corner of a sheet, and it's also a single printed card, yet it's very easy to find in high grade because there was a lot of them that came through on this find in the late 90s. So that being said, when you look at the single printed teams, the Redskins are much harder to find in high grade than the Cardinals cards.
Yeah, I assumed Eddie LeBaron, number 49. I mean, you said they laid out by team, so card number doesn't really correlate to location on a sheet. So
yes.
I assumed Eddie LeBaron somehow landed on a corner. Because a PSA 8.5, one of one, none higher, that's pretty scarce. That's pretty rare.
Oh, yeah.
That's the Zeke
yeah.
Gronkowski.
So,
yep,
in
exactly.
theory, did they, in theory, is it, or can we make an assumption they were on the ends of the sheet and they threw them out, or they saved them, or what do you think? I'm just curious, because we talked about this before over the years.
Are you talking in terms of why there's only a very select number of cards in this big find, Bob?
Yeah.
Yeah,
right,
you know what?
Right.
That
yeah.
is. It's something that, you know, I've thought about it for a while. Like, because, you know, when you have your uncut sheets, you have a 220-card sheet, and then they're split in half to form, like, sheet A, sheet B. If you look at the cards from this find, they're pretty well isolated to the bottom three rows of sheet A, which, you know, you think about it, obviously there must have been an excess, whether the top half of the sheet got ruined, if they, you know, it's an interesting question to ask why there were so many of those cards from the bottom three rows of sheet A. I've yet to hear a real convincing argument or theory as to why, but I'm sure there has to be a reason.
Wow. Kurt, you were working on your 35-72 run. Out of that run, did you have a favorite set or sets in the run?
Nope, absolutely. I would say my favorite set, hands down, is the 52 Bowman Large set. And I tell you what, I talked about my three criteria I kind of, you know, I look at on a set. To me, the 52 Bowman, in my opinion, it's one of the nicest looking sets ever made. They're like little pieces of artwork, in my opinion. It's got a tremendous, you know, group of Hall of Fame rookies, and then the short prints are infamous in that set. So to me, it's like
yep.
that set hits like checks every single box in terms of like a good challenging set to work on.
Yeah, the most popular. I wrote that article, you know, the most popular set, and 52 Bowman was the number one set for the last decade, not even close. I mean, it is by far
yeah.
the most popular
right.
collected set.
Joe, I know yeah. you're a big fan of the 64 top set, but I still put the 52 Bowman after that.
You mean 54
yeah,
Bowman? Or?
No, I was joking. I know you're not a big fan
oh.
of the 64 top set.
Oh, yeah, God, no. I think the 67 top set. Which one's the one with all the weird border stuff? Is that 67 or 64?
Well, 64's kind of got like the stars that go around the border.
Yeah. That set is ridiculous.
Now, Bob, I remember one time Bob discussing the 56 set. I remember you had mentioned, and this is referring to the contest cards. So for the contest cards, you have five different contest cards. You got contest card 1, 2, and 3, and then you have A and B. And I believe you had mentioned at one point that there's kind of a hobby legend out there that supposedly a contest card C possibly existed. Is that something you have ever heard much on?
Yeah, I never confirmed it one way or the other, and I never saw it. So I don't know if it's hiding somewhere or if it did get discovered. I missed it. I don't know. So
yeah.
What's your take on it?
Well, you know what? So one thing that I tried to do is, you know, Mike Thomas has done a great job of, like, recreating
yeah.
all the virtual uncut sheets. The one area he never got into is kind of like, on the checklist and the contest cards, you know, obviously they were cut down from something. So what I tried to do is I went back and I scoured thousands of images trying to find miscut contest cards and checklists. And I think I found enough where I was able to kind of recreate what an uncut contest checklist sheet looked like. And from what I came up with, there wasn't a place for the contest card C, but you know, it wasn't a conclusive sheet that I came up with, but my guess is that does not exist, but it's always fun to hope that it might.
Yeah, I really don't think, you know, I really don't think it was out there, but it probably was and never got distributed or whatever. I really don't know one way or the other. And again, I never collected any of the contest cards, but I did find the two checklists as the years went on for 56 tops and the 57 tops set. And they were pretty difficult to find. And I was never worried about them being unchecked or whatever. You know, I got mine are pretty badly checked. In fact, I'm looking at them right now. And, you know, they are what they
are. Of course you are.
Contest cards are always intriguing to me, and especially that card B. And thanks for jogging my memory on that. I had forgotten about that for quite a few years. But that's interesting that you mentioned it again.
Yeah. The one other kind of interesting anomaly on the 1956 set is there occasionally you'll find four cards from that set that are cut oversized. They will not fit in a standard PSA holder, and they put them in like this jumbo oversized holder, and it's only isolated to four cards. Now, obviously, every time, you know, there's instances of these cards that are proper size, but there's the Buddy Young, there's I believe it's the Chicago Bears team card. And I think it's the Chuck Ulrich, but those cards, there you'll find them often. And if you look at where those cards align on the sheet, they're all on sheet A on the very right edge. It's like the first four cards starting from the bottom right going vertical. Those four cards, for whatever reason, got cut jumbo-sized. And once again, they happen to be in that same sheet section where that big find came from. So maybe the two are related. I don't know, but that's another thing. I was kind of like, why are some of these cards oversized?
All borders are fat, like, equidistant,
yep.
Or is the right border fat?
No. They, from what I've seen, they seem to be fairly, I would say maybe the right edge is slightly bigger, which makes sense because that's the right edge would be the edge of the sheet. If you go too far left, you're going to get into that adjacent card on the sheet. But it's not like the centering's not like crazy off center left to right. The examples that I have, I think they're nines, but they're fairly centered cards. They're just oversized.
Interesting. Okay.
Wow. Which is kind of a nice thing to see cards in our hobby not being short, being actually big for once, right? So that was a trimming joke.
Karen, I'm picking up what you're putting down, brother.
shoot. But yeah, those are some of, like, me, some of the kind of the interesting things that I learned about the 56 football set. There's other things. Like in the 56 set, you'll notice, like, the printing quality was horrendous when it came to, like, fish eyes, print dots, things like that. I mean, throughout the 50s and 60s, I think that's a fairly common problem. But, like, 56 seems to be worse than normal. And the same thing with the centering, too. Like, I go out and buy a lot of, like, childhood collections, original collector collections, and, like, 56 centering is just horrendous coming out of the factory.
Interesting. Yeah.
But yeah,
Bob,
so those are my insights on the 56 set.
Can you hear us?
Yeah. Getting back to what you were saying with the 52 Bowman large set, and again, I've mentioned this numerous times. I started and stopped that set several times, given up on it because of card 144, the Lansford card, and the cost of it. And I do have the 52 small set complete, but I know it doesn't compare to the 52 large set. Joe, back to you.
The Lansford's really interesting because if you look at kind of like PSA's population report, that the Lansford's a short printed card, but it's not like the most rare card in the set by a stretch. I think there's a lot of the first and the last card draws a lot of attention, and for some reason that card just gained a lot of hobby lore about the Lansford's last card in the set. But there's other ones that are quite a bit more difficult.
Yeah. I love that.
Exactly.
Just the math that goes into a divisible by 9 minus 1. I mean, just how it lays out on a sheet, et cetera. You've been collecting for a long, long time. Do you have any interesting stories you want to share with the audience, like meeting strange men in airports with duffel bags?
I got to tell that story. So while I was working on my set, Joe was kind of winding down on his. Joe, it's my understanding that I think you still enjoy the mainstream cards, but I think your focus has now gone earlier into the more kind of rare type items.
Yes, you're spot on. Yeah.
Yeah. So I knew that Joe was kind of selling some of his sets, and his scope was almost identical to mine. So I reached out to Joe. I'm like, hey, listen, let's try to put together a big deal. So we went back and forth several times, and we ended up making a deal on, it was probably, I don't know, Joe, if you remember how many cards, or probably 1,000 cards, somewhere in that range probably, but all graded cards. And it was a pretty big deal, right? I mean, we were talking nice, valuable, older cards. So we come to an agreement on the price, and we're kind of there's always the question that comes, how are we going to actually exchange money and exchange the cards? With that many cards, it starts to become pretty laborious to ship all those. So, Joe's like, I got an idea. He's like, I'm going to send one of my employees. I'm going to fly him out to Iowa. You meet him at the airport, make the exchange. Or maybe it's actually Chicago, I believe. I drove
Chicago.
Up to Chicago. Yeah,
Your wife was flying to Mexico, and that was her stop.
Exactly. You're right. Your memory's better than mine. Exactly. So I remember there was 2 suitcases full of graded cards, and Joe's employee shows up, and I'm waiting for him outside the airport security. He shows up carrying 1 bag. I'm like, this is interesting. There's supposed to be 2 suitcases. And the guy's like, he's like, they wouldn't let me on with those suitcases. I had to check one of them. And I'm kind of like, okay, that's it. Scared me a little bit, but probably not a big deal. We'll just wait for the luggage to come through. Well, the luggage starts to come through, and, the second suitcase doesn't show up. And, panic is starting to ensue. So, I'm starting to sweat bullets, and I'm trying to, maintain calm, but, I'm starting to get nervous because we're going to, the airlines were asking about it, and they finally located the bag, but they're like, listen, they wouldn't let either of us go get the bag. They were going to send it back to, Portland, I think.
Yeah.
And I'm like, crap, this is a nightmare. I ended up kind of sweet talking one of the agents, and they ended up giving me the second bag, but yeah, that was probably one of my more nervous transactions, was buying a big chunk of Joe's collection.
I remember how do you get 2 people who've never met to meet? So it was Sunday, I met him in the morning, gave him the bags, took a picture of him, texted both of you, hey, here's what he looks like, and then you sent a picture of you. So I'm like, two strange men meeting in an airport.
Exactly. So
unbelievable.
That was one memorable event. I would say the 2 other things that really stand out to me, and they're not so much specific stories, but more kind of general things, is one is, as I got more involved in the hobby, you start to meet other people, you start to make friends. And, to me, I think we probably all agree, that's one of the most special parts about the hobby is being able to meet other collectors. And, for me, it's growing up in Iowa, I'm collecting these cards. Nobody else around me can relate to what I'm doing. And they probably think I'm some sort of weirdo. So you meet these other people and they have the exact same passion as you. It's just It clicks with you. And like, so that, I've always enjoyed that aspect of it. And then probably lastly, more from a dealer side, like I said, I go out a lot and I'll buy private collections, and nothing I love more than like going to a childhood collection and like talking to the original owner, hearing the stories. It's like, you know, it's like treasure hunting. So it's like, in terms of like an adrenaline excitement buildup, you know, it's hard to beat that feeling as well.
You know, it's a tough thing to sell a collection. And, I, you know, I've been thinking about it as I've been getting older. You know, I look at my run, and it's not gem mint. You know, it's not graded or anything like that. But I just think back at all the, you know, travels I had putting the set together before the internet, you know, age, and then after the internet, as the internet age became prevalent, finding a lot of hard to find cards, so on and so forth. And I look back and I'm looking at my bookcase right now with all the binders in it. That's going to be really tough for me to sell at the end, type of thing. And you know, now since I moved, I'm being semi-retired now. I have a lot more time, obviously, to do things. And I do spend a lot more time going through my run, pulling an album out every night and really looking at the cards and saying, I really got to improve some of these cards because some of my early cards are nasty. But I also remember the stories when I got them and who I got them from and so on and so forth. So it's great memories. Yeah. It's just, you know, it's a nice thing. And I give you a lot of credit, Kurt, because I can see you coming. If I never knew you and I called you, and, you know, we're looking at it, and, you know, Brenda said already, I'm going to have to take you out of the house when everything gets taken out because you're going to be flipping out, you know, that type of thing. You know, and I get it in a way. You know, I do get it. So it's a fine line a dealer has with a longtime collector. And it's not something like, you know, I got 20 whatever PSA 10 cards. Just give me X amount of dollars. It's done. It's like a commodity. This is something you put a lot of effort in. You put a lot of research in. You put a lot of time in, a lot of money in, blah, blah, blah. You know, it becomes part of you, type of thing. Yep. And I always said the last thing that gets sold out of my collection is that, the run. And that's it. And whoever buys it is going to have to buy the whole thing. It's not going to be piecemeal type of deal. So I give you a lot of credit, you know, dealing with people like that, because I can only imagine the stories you hear and from the people, you know, people you're dealing with, so on and so forth. It's part of them. You're buying part of them.
Absolutely. Very strong emotional attachment to cards. And that kind of goes to the heart of collecting, you know. I mean, I think at some sense, collecting's all about, you know, some sort of, you know, connection to our childhood. You know, there's a lot, you know, I bought a lot of collections, and like, you're absolutely right, Bob. It's like the reactions you see when people give up their collection. It's like a lot of memories, maybe with their fathers or buying the stuff. It's like, there's a lot of emotions are wrapped up in that process.
Yeah.
Stacy knows to bury me with my Largent cards. Problem solved.
Hey, we're down to like 6 minutes, so we're going to have to combine several of the questions all at once. So, Joe, why don't you go before me on your question, and then I'm going to combine the last two.
Yeah, we have you on for the 56, but you've always, some of the cards you bought for me were Hall of Famers. Right now you have the number 3 Hall of Fame rookie card set. Obviously the Hawkeye, named after Iowa Hawkeyes, where you got your GED from. You have a PSA Nagurski. I was just kidding about that. One thing that kind of raised an eyebrow to me, Kurt, you have a PSA 9 Largent. You know, that kind of hurts my heart.
You know, I probably should downgrade that to an 8 or something.
Hey. When we were texting back and forth, you mentioned you'd gotten into unopened. Tell us a little bit about your unopened collection and any trepidations you have about the unopened industry.
Yeah, so, I mean, when I got into the dealer side of things, I actually sold off a lot of my sets. And I did that to kind of, for two reasons. One, to kind of seed some money for the business, but also it's like, it's hard to be both a collector and a dealer, right? It's kind of like you can't be a drug dealer and partake of your own product type mentality. So one thing that I've always enjoyed is unopened. And like I said, as I analyze why, I think as a collector, I've always had some sort of like infatuation about trying to find stuff as original as it came out of the factory as possible. And to me, it's kind of like that really for me defines what unopened is to me. It's like it's the original state these cards hit the you know, retail stores. And for me, it's just kind of like it's almost like a little time capsule of Americana or history. And I think that probably kind of sums up my passion for unopened. And specifically, it's like I have, you know, I collect all types of unopened. I think the one area that I really enjoy is I like unopened cello packs, and I kind of like having like a Hall of Famer on top. I mean, to me, that's always kind of catch my attention, and I tend to go after those.
Yeah. I love that. I'm nodding here, Kirk, because you summed up exactly how I feel. Little time capsules, moments in history, they're not making any more of them, and it's so nostalgic to me to see a wax pack that I opened as a kid and just kind of makes me smile.
Exactly. And to answer your second question, like, oh, go ahead, Bob. We only got a few minutes left. I was going to answer Joe's second part of the question in terms of, like, what's the state of the unopened hobby?
Yeah.
To me, another thing, like I said, you know, the money aspect never drives my collecting, but it's always something in the back of your mind. But to me, it's like unopened's one of those things where the supply is never going up. You see all these companies breaking unopened. The stuff only gets more rare as time goes on. So I'm a firm believer that from a financial standpoint, the unopened stuff, I think it's pretty low risk in terms of, you know, that the value of that dropping, you know, barring some massive find of unopened, but I think it's pretty safe.
All right, we're down to 2 minutes. Kurt, combined question. Any advice for a beginning collector, and how can people contact you and your company?
Yep, so my advice for a collector, and I think it's pretty generic advice, but one is, you know, collecting is all about, as we talked about, it's having something, it's an enjoyable pastime to connect you back to your childhood. So first and foremost, have fun with what you collect. Collect something that you personally enjoy. And the second thing I think I've learned is kind of like, to me, it helped to kind of define a scope in terms of what I was doing. I was kind of a bit like a fart in a skillet when I started out. I'd collect a little of that. I'd get bored of this, bored of that.
Yep.
And I'm like, I kind of said, hey, it's time for me to kind of, you know, assign a scope to what I do. So I would say, yeah, collect what you like and kind of have an idea of, like, what the scope of your hobby is going to look like. And
sounds
then in
great.
Terms of, like, yeah, contacting me, so like I said, my company is BBC Emporium. Myself and my brother, Aaron, are the owners of it. My brother, what I do with baseball cards, he did the exact same with comic books. So we actually do both cards and comics with BBC Emporium, but you can always contact us through eBay, but also you just Google the company. We're pretty easy to find through a quick Google search as well. And we buy and sell. Like I said, I'm a football card guy, but when you step into the dealing world, you know, baseball kind of reigns supreme. But we do baseball, football, pretty much all the sports. And we've also gotten into non-sports as well. I've really enjoyed that segment of the hobby as well. So we're spread pretty broad.
And with that, Kurt, thank you for being on. We are literally out of time. We got 5 seconds left. Thanks for being on, and we'll be back with another show. Take care.
All right. It's a pleasure, guys.
See you, man.
Yep.